In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The point of an actor is to disappear into a role. A great performance by a famous actor is like a magic eye illusion. You look one way and it's Meryl Streep. You squint a different way and you can barely see Meryl at all. The point of a movie star is to never disappear. You see them on the sides of buses. Movie stars are supposed to be products, people who you can never take your eyes off of, who you always want to spend more time with. Sometimes actors can be movie stars and movie stars actors, and that's a neat trick. But often, you're one or the other. There are subgenres of movie stars also. There are action movie stars, Bruce Willis, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who sure can be in other movies, but that's what they're known for, action movies. There are comedy movie stars, Melissa McCarthy, Leslie Jones. And there are, of course, rom-com stars. Sometimes they even come in pairs. Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan, Katherine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy, Julia Roberts, Richard Gere. When casting How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, the studios wanted two stars. They weren't looking for actors to disappear into the roles. They wanted people on the poster who you would walk by and say, "Oh, I like her." Gwyneth Paltrow was attached to the project early on, but scheduling happened. Then a newly nominated for Best Supporting Actress, Kate Hudson, signed on for the movie. They needed to find the perfect guy. A guy with a big name, who wouldn't mind demeaning himself by being in a rom-com, and who had great chemistry with Kate Hudson. And that's how we got our Texas boy in New York City with a weird backstory, Matthew McConaughey. Today, we are going to be discussing stardom and how it all plays out in rom-coms with Russell Mafe. You've heard Russ's name in the credits before. He's been a huge help to us this entire season. Russell is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Media at the University of Idaho. His work focuses on celebrity culture, popular cinema, masculinity studies, and disability studies. He is the author of several books on media culture, including White Terror, the horror film from Obama to Trump. Rebellious Bodies, Stardom Citizenship, and the New Body Politics, and John Wayne's World, Transnational Masculinity in the 50s. I'm Vanessa Zoltan, and this is Hot and Bothered. Hi, Russ. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
I am so excited to talk about this.
We have loved talking to you so much that we just decided that you were a consulting producer on this project. That is how helpful you are. You are in our credits. So thank you for all of your help. And also, I'm so glad that we actually are going to get to hear you on mic today.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this. And I've been so happy to help out and love talking about movies, and rom-coms have a special place in my heart.
Okay, so first, you write a lot about stardom. And rom-coms, I think, are one of the genres that most uses stardom to great effect. And so I'm wondering if you could just tell us what you mean when you use that term. What is a star?
Yeah, so a star is actually kind of a really complicated term when we think about like what that means, because it's a constellation of different ideas we have. When we think of stars, we think about people, right? We think, oh, okay, I know who Will Smith is. I know who Zendaya is, right? But really, stars are these complicated media personas. They're people that we feel like we know, but we don't actually know, that we know a lot about their personal lives and like who they're dating and how many kids they have and where they went to eat last night. But we don't have a personal connection with them. And so stars are these kind of things that look like people, but aren't actually people. They're ideas, they're discourses. We sometimes call them texts, right? We talk about the star text that they embody. And so they work really, really well for a number of purposes in our entertainment media because, one, they're great at marketing. That's primarily the reason why stars exist, is to get us to buy stuff, typically to buy movies. We go see movies on the basis of performances and who's in it and do we like them? How do we feel about them? But they're also really great at helping us process cultural ideas, ideas around what it means to be a person, what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be queer, what it means to exist in this complicated world that we live in. And so when I say star, I mean, a performer who resonates with our culture in a particular way that helps us think about our own identities.
Yeah. I studied English, not film. And one of the only literary theorists that I think I at least a little bit understood was Saussure, who talks about like certain words as not just words that convey meaning, but that are symbols. And so like you say war and it means one thing, but right, like it also is a semiotic system for something so much bigger. And I feel like that's what you're saying about stars, right?
Yeah, that's a great way of thinking about stars. And I think that's actually fundamental to the work of stars, right? Is that we say Matthew McConaughey or Kate Hudson, who we'll talk about in a minute, and we think we know what it means. We can see them in our head. We kind of have a sense of like who they are as people, but it's actually opening up this whole world of discourses about who were they dating in 1999? Who are they married to now? You know, what kind of awards have they won? Thinking about their performances. But this also opens up all these messy ideas around ideology and culture. So one of the great theorists of stardom is a scholar named Richard Dyer. And kind of the example that I use when I talk to people about this, talk to students about this, is Marilyn Monroe as the classic kind of iconic star who resonated so broadly in the 1950s and still today because she was able to take these contradictions around femininity, that women should be at once innocent and pure and naive and a little bimbo-ish, but also very sexually experienced and have the ability to express their own sexual desires. And that's those these classic double binds in Western culture that we put on women. But we don't think about that double bind when we think about Marilyn Monroe. We just see those contradictions smoothed over and it's just Monroe, right? And that's why she resonates, why she's iconic, because she's able to take those contradictions and make them seem like they're not contradictions, make us feel like, oh, that's just what it is to be a woman.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of the star system in Hollywood? Because, I mean, I'm definitely getting a sense, right, that it's not by accident. They're curated. Mm-hmm. And so who was the first star?
Yeah, so the person that we talk about as the first star is a great story. So we'll take you back in time to about 1909. The film industry is still fledgling. None of the major studios as we think of them today are really what they are at this moment. In fact, the studio system at the time is really being dominated by Thomas Edison, who runs this cabal of patent holders who hold the patents on the camera systems. And he's very, very strict about enforcing those patents, to the point that a lot of film historians, we tell these kind of anecdotes about Edison sending goons around to like rough up other people's camera crews because they weren't part of the patent cabal.
To be clear, so there's like an Edison mafia.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thomas Edison is a lot of things. In the history of film, he's a great innovator, but also kind of the bad guy.
Yeah,
so he's very much trying to enforce this cabal. His company is called Biograph, and one of their top performers was this woman named Florence Lawrence. But nobody knew her name because at the time, they didn't put credits at the end of films. They didn't say who the performer's names was, partly because many of the performers didn't want to be associated with this fledgling film industry, right? It was seen as not a respectable career path. But the fans wanted to know who these people were. And so Florence Lawrence became famous first just as the Biograph Girl. Early fan magazines started writing about the Biograph Girl, and she's the Biograph Girl has a new film coming up. But then as her contract was starting to expire with Biograph, she started searching out for other companies that she could work with. Biograph got wind of this and fired her. This was a period in which the stars didn't really have a lot of power in the industry. So they were like, hey, no, I don't care how famous you are, you're done. So she starts looking for other work, and she connects up with one of the independent companies. So these are the companies that are outside of Edison's cabal. They're small, they're fledgling, they're trying to grow, and they're trying to challenge the way that films get made and trying to challenge that business model. And so one of these companies called IMP, the Independent Motion Picture Company, they sign on Florence Lawrence to work for IMP. This was run by Carl LaMale, who was an early film pioneer, and he was also a great promoter of film. And so he knew that signing Florence Lawrence was just the start. He needed to promote that he had this person. And so what he did was he planted fake news stories across New York City papers claiming that the Biograph Girl was killed by a streetcar in an accident on the streets of New York City. And so for a day, the papers run this story, oh, this Biograph Girl, she's dead. And then he comes out the next day and says, the rumors are false. Those are just false rumors planted by my rivals. The Biograph Girl is alive. She's now signed with IMP, and her name is Florence Lawrence. And so this has got like the first time that we've named a star. She gets a big contract with IMP, and he recognizes the marketing potential, right? That it's not just the movies that people are going to see. They're going to see the performers. They're going to see those stars. And so Carl LaMale and his IMP company expands greatly. They eventually move to Southern California because it's far away from Edison and has better weather and more topography. And as his company grows, he realizes he needs to give it a better, bigger name, a more expansive name. And so, of course, he names it Universal Pictures. And so that's the origin story of how stars and the studios come together.
So, I mean, like what I know about the film industry can basically fit on my thumbnail, but this is exciting to know because I feel like we're going to be on an upward trajectory where stars have more and more power, right? Stars are going to create United Artists with Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin. And then stars again are going to create First Artists with Barbara Streisand and Sidney Poitier. And like now every star has their own production company. And so it seems as though if we think about film history, it started as like stars as assets that were owned, and then stars realizing, no, we are our own assets. And that means that like we should own our own images.
Yeah, absolutely. So as the studio system grows in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, stars were absolutely seen as, the assets is a good way of putting it. They were in very, very tight contracts with the studios, typically for 7 years, in which they had no autonomy and control. And some stars tried to buck that. They would sue the studios occasionally and often would lose or create their own production companies to create some autonomy. As the studio system starts to wane in the late 40s and 50s and just doesn't have the power it does anymore, then stars start branching off, start creating their own production companies so that they can exercise that sense of autonomy over which projects they pick. And actually, the industry then becomes very much organized around talent agencies more than studios. Which big talent agency are you signed with? Who's helping you craft your persona and craft your career as you move forward? And that gives the stars a little bit more autonomy. But they still serve the same essential role, which is that the studios need the stars to promote their films. And the stars need the studios to pay their bills and get those jobs. But yeah, we see this trajectory where the stars get more and more freedom to try to craft their roles, but it's still in kind of, this relationship with the studios and what the studios want and need.
Yeah, I often think of something that I learned at some point, which is that when you sign a contract to work on a movie as an actor, part of your job is to act in that movie, but just as much a part of your contract is the promotions after the movie. And that is actually, you think of someone as an actor as like their time on stage or their time on the set, but actually part of the job description of actor is this other part, which is performing stardom.
Absolutely. And sometimes the promotional aspect of being a star takes up more time and space and energy than the actual shoot itself. And some stars, as they get more power, can leverage that. There's often this tension. Some stars are very vocal about how much they don't like the promotion part of it. They just see their job as acting and performing. But especially rising stars know that that's absolutely part of playing that game and getting that next role is being a good team player on the promotion side of things.
Right. And this makes total sense, right? You've written about the relationship between stardom and neoliberal citizenship. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I feel like we're circling on that.
Yeah. So that was a book that I wrote called Rebellious Bodies, where I was very interested in particularly our contemporary moment of stardom, really thinking about the mid-2000s onward, where stars historically we've talked about as being very normative in terms of identity, that there are strict boundaries on who we imagine as a star, particularly when it was very tightly controlled by the studio system. And even as stars gain more power, if you were a woman and a star, you had to look a particular way, you had to act a particular way. If you were a woman of color star, those parameters were so narrow in terms of what was allowed for your identity. And the same thing for men as well, right? That there was body standards, there was more variety and diversity in how you could be a male star than a female star, but there was all these parameters on that. But we started seeing, particularly as the culture has shifted post-civil rights movement, more and more emphasis on diversity and stardom and thinking about how can we make room for stars who have different kinds of bodies, who inhabit different types of personas, and then how that helps us think about identity, who really belongs. So when I talk about citizenship, I think citizenship in the cultural sense, right? Not who has rights necessarily, but who culturally belongs, who is seen as being part of kind of the mainstream central part of our culture, which is, of course, then tied to rights, especially when you think about changes in rights for the LGBTQ community. So I'm really interested in that idea of how stars embody that idea of like what it means to be a part of the mainstream culture. And that's constantly shifting and changing in neoliberal capitalism, which is seeking to expand its markets and have more people be brought into this idea of the mainstream, but is also then brushing up against our cultural boundaries of what appropriate identities should be.
Right. Okay, let's talk about our stars. First of all, Matthew McConaughey, you have things to say about a moment in time that could be called the McConaissance. Can you please tell me about Matthew McConaughey and the McConaissance?
So How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days comes out in about 2003, and it's near the early end of this kind of period of time in McConaughey's body of work that is very much dominated by rom-coms. He doesn't do exclusively rom-coms. There's a few other films in there, but that's how he really cements his status as a leading man. Much of his work in the 90s, he's part of an ensemble cast where there's other stars that are help carrying the promotional work of the film. He, like a lot of stars who do rom-com work, starts getting typecast through those different roles and starts realizing this is what's coming his way, which, you know, is not always bad for many actors. We talk about it as a bad thing, but it also helps make them very rich and very successful in their careers. And so starting around 2009, 2010, he actually takes a little bit of a break and stops taking a lot of roles because he's worried about this typecasting. He wants to be a serious actor. Many of his early roles in the 90s are very serious type performances.
Time to Kill.
Time to Kill, absolutely. Contact with Jodie Foster, right?
Where I remember someone famously said he plays the girl in that movie.
Absolutely. He's the sensitive person trying to get Jodie Foster to like open up emotionally, right? So, but yeah, so he wants to be serious. And so, yeah, it's around that time. Mud is 2012, but he does Bernie, that dark comedy with Richard Linklater.
I love Bernie.
Yeah, that's 2011. And Magic Mike is also 2012, which is a little bit of like a bridge kind of a film. It's still people's sexiest man alive, Matthew McConaughey, but in a more serious like package around that, right? And then Mud solidifies this, right? And I think part of this is also he's well known as a Southern actor, right? He's got that very great, sexy kind of like Texas-y draw, but not too Texas-y. That's very specific to him. And so he takes on a lot of roles like Mud, Dallas Buyers Club, obviously True Detective, and others that really play into this kind of gritty, southerny, gothic moment that allows him to say, okay, I'm not a rom-com actor anymore. I'm Matthew McConaughey. I'm a serious actor. And yes, we call it the McConaissance as he's reinvented his career.
And has he gone back and done a rom-com since? Or once you McConaissance, can you not go back?
You can go back. I'm trying to think
but
of other performances.
You don't want to.
You don't want to. And you have to establish yourself pretty solidly to be able to go back. Think about Tom Hanks took a kind of similar trajectory in the 90s where was like, okay, I'm a comedic actor, but I am going to be a serious actor. And then he wins back-to-back Oscars in the early 90s. And he's Tom Hanks. He's beloved. He's an icon. He gets to the point in his career where he can do a lot of stuff and he can be like, yeah, I'll team up with Meg Ryan again and do You've Got Mail. That's okay. I'm solid in my Tom Hanksiness that I can do that. I think yeah. McConaughey, I'd have to look at his oeuvre, but I don't think he's really gone back that direction. Partly because the place he pivoted to was a lot darker, a lot grittier. And so his persona, his text that he's created since, you know, the around 2010 or so doesn't really vibe with rom-coms anymore.
Right. It is so funny the way that there's cultural cachet around these dramas, right? Like Mud is a better movie than How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. But like, I mean, I can even think just Tom Cruise. Everybody was really excited when he did Collateral. People were a lot less excited when he did Jerry Maguire. Mm-hmm. And I feel like at the Oscars every year, there's this conversation of like, why not value movies people actually like to see? Like if part of what you want to be as an actor is famous and a celebrity, not a lot of people saw Mud, but a lot of people saw The Wedding Planner. And so why as an actor are you like, I want to be in Mud that 200,000 people are going to see instead of The Wedding Planner that like 200 million people are going to see?
Yeah, and this, I think, is a long history of
snobbery.
Yeah, we're thinking about these ways that, like, comedy and popularity and things that are enjoyed by the masses are necessarily denigrated culturally, that they're not taken seriously, they're not seen as things for serious artists, right? It's part of the ways in which we've also internalized this idea, particularly for male actors, and I think this plays out along gendered lines, that to be seen as a craftsman actor, like a method actor, an actor who takes the craft seriously, you have to do roles that are not going to be hyper popular, but that are going to be critically acclaimed, that might win Oscars, something like Dallas Buyers Club, which wasn't a failure by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly wasn't a mega hit. And this, I think, goes to a long history of the ways in which method acting has become, and this idea of the method has become the way that we signal masculine skill and professionalism for actors. And you can't do that in a rom-com. But it's also tied to just long histories of, you know, rom-coms are women's films, and so we don't take them seriously. Whereas action films, which are equally as melodramatic and schlocky, we take a little bit more seriously.
Okay? Right.
And so it makes sense that McConaughey would partly pivot by also partnering with somebody like Chris Nolan through a film like Interstellar, which is that perfect kind of like, we're going to do a serious art film, but make it blockbustery, right? And make it something that a lot of people are going to go and see, which is that niche that Nolan has kind of occupied.
Yeah. So who is Matthew McConaughey in 2003 when he gets hired on The Shop? I am 41 years old. So I remember when Matthew McConaughey became a thing. It was like overnight, he was in a movie with Sandra Bullock. It mm-hmm. was a John Grisham movie. And then we all were like, oh, he was that creep in Dazed and Confused. But like, overnight, he was this like beautiful Southern fighting for the good of Samuel L. Jackson. He like came in like a hero.
Yeah, absolutely. And his trajectory is actually very similar to like what it would have been in the studio era if the studios had choreographed it. He starts in like, yeah, a small indie film like Dazed and Confused and gets a film credit and then works his way up through these kind of like regional, like again, Southern, he does Lone Star, right? Another ensemble cast, and then really breaks through with A Time to Kill. Again, in a moment in which the marketing team doesn't have to be, this is a Matthew McConaughey film. And it was very much, this is a Sandra Bullock film. This is a Samuel L. Jackson film.
Even though they are both super minor characters, it's Matthew McConaughey film.
It's his film, but you look at the promotions, you look at the posters and stuff, and it's like equal weighting for everybody. that's a typical strategy, right? Is you have a new star and you're trying to figure out like, hey, we like this guy. We're trying to figure out what to do with him. Put him in something where he doesn't have to carry it the whole way. Even though his performance certainly carries the film, then the promotion, he doesn't have to carry it. And so then he gets established. He does a couple things. They put him with Jodie Foster in Contact. So he's not the primary star in that movie either. Yeah. And then they start, okay, this is the career trajectory for him. But then in 2001, he does Wedding Planner, and that starts this string of rom-coms that he takes in, where that's where he becomes the lead, right? He becomes the asset that can be used to promote these films. And I mean, I think he's great in them. I mean, I think he performs really wonderfully in rom-coms, which is why some of these films are really fun.
And he's great at promoting them, right? He like flirts with every single person who interviews him. And so those clips are amazing, right? Like he's flirting with David Letterman.
Yeah, he's really charming on the press circuit. He's great with interviewers. He's great on TV performances. So he's kind of like tailor-made for this and gets in that trajectory. So yeah, in 2003, when this comes along, this is kind of a path that he's going down. Is like, okay, if you want to be a leading man, it's a leading man in rom-coms, which for male actors, right, it can be, you know, rom-coms, sometimes action. Today, it's superheroes, right? But that was a very clear path to, okay, you do these big rom-com movies, and if they do well, you'll get bigger and bigger payouts. And then oftentimes it's with that caveat, like then you do enough of them, you can then make your own path. And yeah, and part of this is it's a little bit of typecasting, but he's also really perfectly suited for a lot of these roles because the rom-com, men in rom-coms are always trying to balance these set of expectations, right? That they're man's men, right? That they have this kind of masculine aura about them. Sometimes they're bad boys, but we need to believe that they can also be vulnerable and also be sensitive and also open up, right? So like in Wedding Planner, he's like, it's kind of a hard role in that he's someone who's thinking about cheating on his fiance the whole movie. That's hard to pull off, right? To be like likable as the person who's doing something really shady. And similar dynamics in How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, in that he's playing a kind of like sensitive frat boy type who mostly makes kind of misogynistic commercials around beer and sports, but really wants to reach out to women and connect with women. And so he can be more sensitive. And then Failure to Launch, he becomes that same kind of like, oh, I'm the stereotype of the person who won't leave their parents' basement.
I have to interrupt. I watched it last night to prepare for this interview. It is legitimately one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my life. If you want to become a Matthew McConaughey completist, don't. I here give you permission to skip this one.
I would agree. I mean, I think as a scholar, I find it fascinating for that moment because you can see the ways, and same thing with How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, it's that these public discourses around dating, around men and boys, and this idea of people not leaving their parents' basement, those kind of ideas that are in the zeitgeist are like finding their ways into these rom-coms. And so I think it's a fascinating cultural object, but it's poorly executed. But yeah, right. But it ties into what we think of that persona for McConaughey, right? And that he's, again, thinking about those contradictions around masculinity, right? That he can be the guy who is, you know, stuck in his parents' bedroom at age 35, as long as we create a backstory that really makes it like he's not just a loser. He's mourning. He's in grief, right? And he has to work through it. He can be the kind of frat boy style advertising executive with his hyper-masculine office with beer ads in it and everything, as long as he can be sensitive, right? And so that's those contradictions that those roles in McConaughey navigate, right? That he's both that kind of like tap into these kind of cultural ideas around struggling manhood and types of men that are maybe like denigrated in the culture, but can also be sweet and sexy and kind and looks good with his shirt off.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns.
Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So Kate Hudson, where is she in 2003 in her stardom? She's been Penny Lane in Almost Famous.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's had a bunch of small parts, little teeny tiny parts. She was in that 200 Cigarettes film, which is a big ensemble cast. But then, yeah, Penny Lane kind of breaks her onto the scene. And obviously, she has an easier job breaking onto the scene, being the daughter of Goldie Hawn and being raised by Kurt Russell. But Almost Famous helps kind of solidify her persona. Right? And again, for the stars, it's as much about the performance that they give and also kind of that constellation of ideas. So she becomes this kind of it girl, cool girl in this moment. The girl who can hang with the guys as she does in Almost Famous, where she's almost more comfortable with all of the male band members and traveling, and she can be in those spaces, but is also just like really cool and chic and sexy. And so she can embody these ideas of like the hyper feminine it girl, but someone who's really relaxed and easygoing. And it's interesting, McConaughey's character, Ben, in the movie describes her in that way. Like he's all, where's that really easygoing girl who likes sports that I met on that first night, right? So yeah, so she comes into this kind of really on the upswing, and also for her puts her on this a pretty significant rom-com trajectory, playing a lot of those similar roles.
And she, like, she's a baby child, right? She's like 23 when she's making this movie.
Yeah, she's pretty young, although certainly not young by Hollywood standards when they would cast somebody for a role like this. But yeah, and I think actually I'm trying to think too. She's young. Almost Famous is a big hit, but she was also, most people don't remember, she was in that Heath Ledger film, The Four Feathers. It was a major bomb. Nobody saw it. And so How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days was kind of a lifeline for her in this moment in her career, right? She'd had this iconic role as Penny Lane, and she needed something else like iconic to solidify that, because you don't want to like have this great breakout role and then follow it with flops, because then your career stalls out.
So McConaughey is the anchor of this film, and she is the, like, he's top billing. He's the reason it's going to succeed.
Yeah, I think he's the more marketable commodity in the promotion of the film. And she's kind of like a rising star that they're coupling with it. But this helps solidify her stardom as well, right? And helps kind of get her to the point where she could get top billing. But obviously in their trajectories, McConaughey has like did the rom-com thing, pivoted, and has now risen to the ranks of kind of A-list high-performing stars. Whereas Hudson has more, she's had a moment in the mid-2000s and has kind of flatlined a little bit more in terms of her career than he has, for sure.
Well, her career in selling leggings has really taken off. So
yeah, right. And she's been open, right, that she makes most of her money and does well in her with her fashion ventures acts sometimes, right? Like she was in Glass Onion, which was a fun role.
And she was hilarious.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's brilliant because it shows that she's someone who's willing to make fun of herself or make
absolutely.
Fun of her, the perception that some people might have of her.
Absolutely. We always love it when stars poke fun at themselves. We love stars. We also love to hate stars. And mm-hmm. so we really enjoy it when stars are self-deprecating about their own stardom and about their own personas.
Okay, so before I let you go, Russ, a star emerges in this film, introducing Catherine Hahn. The best friend in rom-coms is something that gets discussed a lot. Catherine Hahn, like, this actually ended up kind of being her breakout role. What is so special about Catherine Hahn in this movie that she actually took the best friend and like became this leading lady?
Yeah, and actually, it's been a long trajectory. I mean, Catherine Hahn's kind of an interesting leading lady, in that she's really carved out a space for herself as what we'd think of as like a character actor, like someone who is often not necessarily the anchor of the film, but is going to take on really central roles in both film and TV, that are like central supporting roles. And yeah, and she was obviously like, this was a great breakout role for her, in that it showcased a lot of her talents, right? And that like she's funny in like her performance of this kind of like over the top like femininity that's trying to like grapple with the world. The scene where she pretends to be the couple's counselors, she's really great in that. I love Catherine Hahn. I think she's amazing in almost everything she does. But yeah, like she, the best friend in a rom-com is actually a really appropriate role for her career trajectory, because she played a lot of those supporting roles throughout a lot of her career and has done really, really well at them. And before she started moving into really more recently, as she got a little older, some of these more kind of leading roles, but usually not in really big budget stuff. She's not necessarily had like a really big budget, yes, we think you can anchor a film. But part of that is also just the landscape of stardom has changed in the streaming era, and that we've become much more focused on intellectual property and less on stars. And it's only the really top tier of stars that are used to really anchor films, which is why we have so few stars who are under the age of 45, who are like really anchor stars today.
Right. She anchored the Disney Plus Marvel show.
Well, she started as a supporting character in WandaVision and is now moving into that one, right? So that's kind of a pivot for her, and we'll see how it goes. I mean, I think she's awesome and amazing. This is a great open, like, breakout role for her. So,
yeah, I like ending this conversation talking about her and how much we love her.
We can end every conversation talking about Catherine Hahn. She's the best. Yeah.
Well, Russ, thank you so much. Even better than ending a conversation talking about Catherine Hahn is ending a conversation just saying thank you for being so supportive of this project. And we really didn't know what we were doing, because the whole point of this project is, what is film? And so you've just been holding our hand through that with such grace and knowledge. And thank you so much for coming on today, but also for all of your work.
I have enjoyed every moment of it. This is so fun. Love talking movies and stars and rom-coms and our culture. So happy to help.
So as always, we are now going to get the great Hannah Rehack on the phone. We are going to be watching a scene, and we will simultaneously be wondering about the star power of Maddie Premaconnaissance and Kate in this, like, very cringeworthy scene. Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
Woo! This scene that we're talking about today, it's a lot.
It's definitely a lot. Once again, my heart is racing because you're going to ask me to summarize it.
I am. Please do.
Okay. Ben is having a guy's night flanked by friends of his we don't really know. And then his like two best buds as well, who he works with, played by Adam Goldberg and Thomas Lennon. And she's crashed the party. Andy has crashed the party, the poker night. And we pick up with him making the crazy signal, like twisting his finger around his ear, like she's nuts to his buddies. She sees it. She comes in. She calls him out on it. She's like, I can't believe that would insinuate that I'm nuts. She throws a plate of food. His friends try to cover for him. She's like, no. She shoves the love fern in his face. She runs to the elevator. He chases her out. The dog follows, the ugliest dog in the world, the ugliest, cutest dog in the world.
Oh my God. I think this dog is so cute.
Me too, but for me, there's a fine. There's actually no line between ugly and cute dogs. They are one and the same for me. And he's like, "What's going on? What just happened in there? Where's the cool, sexy Andy I know?"
It's important that part of that he lists the one who wants to be a serious journalist.
Yeah, the one who wants a career in journalism. Like, where is she? What's up? What's with all this like up and down? And I honestly don't even remember what she says, because I was so consumed by that.
She says something like, so I guess we're done. I'm crazy, so I guess we're
done. Yes, right. And he's like, I guess so. Then she goes in the elevator. He picks up the dog, walks back into the apartment. When she goes in the elevator, she looks so relieved.
Wait, she looks so relieved, but then she also does this, oh no, am I sad?
Like, wait, huh, there's a different feeling. What is this feeling so sudden and new?
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, he talks to his friends and they try to convince him to go back in. He's like, no. And then they start imagining, you know, great, well, you're just going to be working on silly campaigns from now on, including, you know, a douching campaign. Like, they throw that as like a one-liner of like the low-level women's product, not diamonds, but hygiene products. And then he's like, okay, fine. And he runs out onto his fire escape and does sort of like a Mission Impossible style dance down all the way to the sidewalk just in time for her to arrive. He says, let's do couples therapy. She thinks about it. She agrees. He thinks they're like in a better place. And she's like, I love you, but I don't have to like you. She walks away, absolutely baffled that he has chased after her. And he looks like he can't believe he has to do this for another few days. And that's it.
Yeah. We find out it's 4 more days. The only thing I have to add is that I think the most crucial line in the film is in this scene. And that is when she looks at him and says, haven't you had enough?
It's so insulting.
It's horrible. But I do think it's a really important line, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's cluing us in to the fact that cool Andy cannot understand why Ben would be putting up with a woman with feelings who matches a purse with a dress.
And what's so disappointing is she's not wrong. She's not wrong to doubt that it's insincere.
Right.
Like, that's that essential flaw of the film, where it's like her internalized misogyny is telling her, like, no man would do this. And then it's like, well, it's actually not just internalized misogyny. It's actually by the standard of the reality of the movie. That's true. No man would do this unless they were trying to get a diamond ad campaign.
Right. Because the other thing that his friends say, they're like, you're going to be doing dumb ad campaigns the rest of your life. And do you think that the Judys are going to enjoy their new office? Right. So it's like his pride is on the line and money is on the line. And he needs both of those things to be on the line in order to put up with her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he'd be losing to the Judys are those two women, right?
Right. He can't lose to women.
Yeah, he'd be losing to women. It's very grim. I mean, we talked about this last episode, I think, but like, there's just really something very, very sad to me that, like, for her, the game he's playing is making her more of an optimist about men.
Yeah.
And like, the game that she's playing feels consistent with his relationship to women.
Yeah. And I think that you just helped me articulate why I think that line, haven't you had enough, is so important. Because she's like, I wouldn't date this person. I'm imitating my friend Michelle, and I would never put up with my friend Michelle. Because what Andy just did upstairs, I mean, like, obviously throwing a plate is really bad. Although I couldn't tell upon this watching if it's supposed to be a paper plate. But she did just witness him calling her crazy, and then a group of men gaslighting her about the fact that they just called her crazy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Having a big reaction to that and being like, screw all of you, I'm taking my plant and leaving. Mm-hmm. Like, this is actually a very reasonable response. And so for her to be like, God, it's so weird that you want to make this work, rather than like, why aren't you on your hands and knees apologizing for calling me crazy?
It's also like his version of like talking that through. And I want to say, for the record, like, I know this is a comedy and I'm mostly interested in that part of it. But when I think about why I don't like this movie or what rubs me the wrong way, it's like, because if I were to take it seriously, what ultimately happens is, instead of like racing after her to the elevator to be like, I was like, so rude of me to call you crazy, I'm feeling like so overwhelmed by your behavior, I shouldn't have been like talking behind your back when you're in the room, you know, whatever the thing is.
Yeah.
And instead it's like, he's trying to win her back through this really problematic, insulting condescension that I definitely have experienced in relationships with men, of being like placating and trying to get over the moment and smooth things over, to then probably go back into the other room and be like,
bitches be crazy.
Great. God, I said the right thing to her. Like, there's an answer. Like, that whole kind of losing game that heterosexual relationships put women in, that make men feel like there's a right answer, quote unquote, and that like they have to get it right. And then you'll forgive them. And then, you know, everything will be fine. And it's like, it's not that. And that's actually a really like condescending way to move through a relationship. I'm getting so angry. I'm like, I want to like flip a paper plate. I'm getting annoyed thinking about it. But I'm like, that's how he's approaching conflict. And I think the way he's approaching conflict is super, super gendered. And that's almost the part that leaves the worst taste in my mouth.
Right. Because you are supposed to think that she is the crazy one in this scene, to use the language of the film, right?
Yeah.
You're not actually supposed to judge him in this scene.
Right.
In fact, you're supposed to think, oh, wow, Andy in the elevator is like kind of bummed that she's not going to get to date this guy. Let's talk about the McConaughey of it all. I did notice the big thing that I noticed is he does a lot of this thing where he shows off his arms a lot. He's like constantly lifting his arms above his head.
Yeah, he is.
In order to show me his arms. And he is wearing this t-shirt that is like obviously tailored to within an inch of its life to be like very tight over his abs and like perfectly cinched over his arms and look like it's from Old Navy and like he just put it on. And then, yeah, I love your point of him doing this sort of like stuntman level thing where it's clearly him the whole way going down that fire escape. Matt McConaughey did his own stunts and How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
hot news.
But like he did, right? And like this is a stunty thing that he does. And it's just counting on his charm to distract us from how heinous this is.
Mm-hmm. And it largely works for me upon, I guess, now the fifth viewing of this film. Like months ago when you came to me, Vanessa, and you said, what do you think about us doing this movie? And I said, I don't think you should do it. And then you lovingly were like, well, guess what? A few days later, we've decided we are doing it.
Thank you for your input, though.
Yes, yes. You put your argument was that you're like, but it has everything. It has all the components of a romantic comedy in a way that are clear and obvious and we can like dig into them. And then that'd be a great foundation for the rest of the season. And this scene, particularly Matthew McConaughey going down the fire escape, makes me think of that because that is such a classic part of a rom-com, which is typically the male lead doing something somewhat physically strenuous that shows urgency and physical prowess. And not to spoil movies that you will talk about, but like if we think about 10 Things I Hate About You and like Heath Ledger doing his song and dance on the bleachers, right? Like that is actually part of male showmanship. Even though she doesn't see it, he's actually not really performing his masculinity for her in this film. He's mostly performing it for us. And we get to be like, that's really sexy. Like, that's really cool the way you move and the way that you're like pretty embodied.
Yeah. I mean, even Billy Crystal and When Harry Met Sally, like we get shots of him running to her, right? Like,
you're like, even Billy Crystal, even tiny little Billy Crystal.
I mean, you just like don't think of When Harry Met Sally as like a very physical movie,
right?
Like it's a lot of shots of the two of them. It's very talky. But there is an action sequence at the end where he's like dodging traffic and running through the streets of New York in order to get to her. Yeah. And we're going to see it again. He's going to go off on a motorcycle for her. But I think that, this like men running after women thing and like having to like physically jump over things in order to get to her. Is absolutely one of the components. The other thing this movie has in a like not obvious way is a makeover. It kind of has a reverse makeover, but it does have like so much clothing because Andy has to switch her style in order to be like annoying looking. And so you get these two different looks, right? It's very like Pretty Woman, the pre-rich man look and the post-rich man look, or the famous 27 dresses montage, where I just rewatched not a rom-com, but Devil Wears Prada, right? Like movies geared toward women, like have a section at one point where you're kind of flipping through a fashion magazine. And I love that. And this movie has that. It feels like you're flipping through a fashion magazine. And there are like sight gags with her outfits. Mm-hmm. Like when you realize in the scene that her purse matches her dress, you're like, oh my God, right? Like,
yeah. I'm looking forward to hearing you talk more about that throughout the rest of the season in the sense that I think montages are a really interesting sight of like transformation. Like that is what they are. And like what is so attractive to a woman audience about the promise of transformation in relation to the change in their relationships or the change in their status in their career or whatever it is. Like, what is driving this desire to feel like you can be different versus like, if we compare it to not it's like a binary, but compare it to the physical action of the man in the movie that we're going to get promised. it's like, what is the promise of that to a male viewer or to a woman viewer as well? To be like, it's the promise of you being chased or somebody
being able to protect you, being like physically strong and able to protect you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And elegant. I'll say Matthew McConaughey, very elegant.
Yeah. I couldn't stop thinking about the hair person who perfectly placed his curls before that kitchen scene. I was like, oh my God, someone came and like wrapped it around their finger and perfectly placed it on his forehead. And I just really loved thinking about that upon this viewing. I was like, he's a product that they've put together for me, right? They've packaged up this product for me and they're like, here you go. It's like, you will find this attractive. And the only thing that I wish this movie had for us to talk about this season is a male product that I wanted to purchase that like I found attractive. There's something about McConaughey that like it just doesn't work on me. And most of these male products do. I'm like Channing Tatum and Step Up. Yes, right? Like usually I'm just like, yes, I love these products and I'll eat them with butter. But McConaughey, man, he's sleazy. I just can't get on board with a man who I'm fairly confident I would walk by, he'd pinch my butt, and if I told him it bothered me, he would tell me to chill out.
Yeah. I mean, he is a larger-than-life actor at this point. Like, his personhood as a real celebrity, I'll say, not real person, but a celebrity, is definitely, it definitely informs the way we read him. Now we know he has, like, a tequila brand or whatever it is, and is, like, the Lincoln car, like... like we know what products and like what like echelon he's sort of representing, and we know that he's a Republican, and we know that like we know so much about him.
I know
now
too
that
much.
I think like the smarminess is like you're like, yeah, I can't like forget it because it's like so
it's dripping, you know, off of him.
Present. Yeah. That said, I can forget it and I do.
Every time he lifts his arm and shows you his delts,
I'm just like, yeah, I'm like, pick me up.
I bet you could carry me down that fire escape.
I bet you could carry me. I can't help myself. I need help. Oh, yes, we contain multitudes.
Hannah, thank you so much. A pleasure as always.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Hot and Bothered. We are a small show, so we really do need your support to run. If you can, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/hotandbotheredrompod. If you love the show, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Tell me I'm just like Kate Hudson. I can't hear it enough. We are Not Sorry Production. Our executive producers are Caitlin Hoffmeister and me, Vanessa Zoltan. A huge thank you this week to our consulting producer and special guest this week, Russell Maith. And if you want to hear him analyze a scene with me, you can hear that on our Patreon. We are edited and produced by Ariana Nettleman, and we are distributed by Acast. Thanks as always to our soulmate level patrons, Gretchen Sneegas, whose window we would hold a boombox outside of, Molly Reilly, who we would chase through an airport to declare our love to, Becky Boo, who we would wait for hours on the top of the Empire State Building for, Elizabeth Schweisenberg, whose heart we would play a game of one-on-one basketball for, and Claudia Hammerman, who we would give the whole door to float on, even if there was room for both of us. And to our team, Julia Argy, Nikki Zoltan, AJ Uramas, Hannah Rehack, Margaret H. Wilson, Courtney Brown, Natalie Folkerts, Fedius Reyes, and Stephanie Paul Sell. Thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you later. And sorry, as always.
turning my brain rotten. My mom listened to it. She was like, I just worry that she's convincing you it's a good movie. And it's not.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact?
you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.